From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 18th day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities. He's in New Market, Indiana. And Mike Barwinski, a senior trader with Louis Dreyfus Commodities, will join us to take up the agricultural energy markets. In the second half hour of our program today, on many of these stations and always online at WILLAG.org, we'll talk with Steve Fogelsong. He's the president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. Hey, and in just 26 minutes, meteorologist Don Day will join us for a look at the agricultural weather forecast. You should stay with us for this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media from the University of Illinois.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
In Chicago, on this Tuesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. In the nearby July wheat, a settlement price on the afternoon at $4.67¾, down a penny and a quarter for the day. September at $4.85¼, down 1 cent. And December wheat at $5.16½, a penny lower for the soft red. July hard red in Kansas City at $4.88, a settlement price 2 cents lower. From the corn pit in Chicago, CME Group, $3.59¾, up 3¾. September, $3.68¼, up 4¼. And December corn at $3.78½, 4¾ higher. March contract, $3.91, up 4½ cents. And the May corn at $3.99½, up 4¼. July soybean futures, $9.39½, down a penny and a half on the day. The August contract at $9.33¾, down 1½. And September futures there at $9.18 a bushel, down 2¾. The harvest month, November soybeans, $9.13½, down 3 cents. January at $9.22½, down 3. July soybean meal at $2.73.60, down 30 cents on the afternoon. August at $2.69.60, down a dollar even. July soybean oil, $37.19, 6 cents higher, as was the August at $37.41. CME Group Livestock, June live cattle futures, $92.75, 25 cents higher. August at $91.52½, up 32½ cents. May feeder cattle at $109.75, a dime higher. The August at $112.57½, up 52½ cents. June lean hogs today at $81.30, down 20 cents. And the July futures at $81.87½, 100 pounds. July lean hog futures settled 27½ cents higher on this Tuesday afternoon. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, $69.16 a barrel, down 91 cents. Ethanol at $1.60¾, down a penny and 3 cents. And the natural gas at $4.34¾, down 5½ cents. Heating oil or diesel fuel, 2¾ cents or 2¾ cents lower, at $1.95¾. And the gold futures for the day at $1,214.30 an ounce. The settlement price down $13.40. The Dow now down just about 106 points at 10,519 on the afternoon. And the Goldman Sachs for the day at 486.40 is down 1.0 for the day. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region looks like from our own Mike Sola. He says for this evening in western Illinois, clear to partly cloudy skies. In far eastern Indiana, a few showers, some patchy drizzle. Elsewhere, mostly cloudy. Lows this evening from 45 in northeastern Indiana to 54 in the western parts of Illinois. Tomorrow in the south and in central sections of Indiana, partly to mostly cloudy. Elsewhere, partly to mostly sunny. Highs tomorrow will range from 66 in eastern Indiana to 75 in the western parts of Illinois. The computer models are suggesting that after occasional showers across the two-state area for the next couple of days and some significant warm-up will develop, the flooding situation along the Mississippi will worsen in the short term, but with below-average precip expected over the next 2 weeks, those areas experiencing high water now will be able to return to field activity soon enough. Warmer weather will shift from the southern plains into the Midwest. Over the weekend, eastern sections will be slower to recover, but through the end of the month, available for Illinois and Indiana, they should see above-average temperatures and improving conditions. More on the ag weather when we get to the bottom of the hour and we talk with Don Day, Jr. You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. On this Tuesday afternoon, we're joined to take a look at the ag futures markets by Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Wayne.
Why, good afternoon, Todd.
Tell me what happened in the marketplace and who's responsible.
Well, we started out the day, of course, with the crude oil being sharply higher, the dollar being a little lower, and the Deutschmark and the euro dollar making some recovery after we'd hit some very good support points and resistance points, and felt like we're going to have a higher day through most of the day. And then about the short part of the day left, why the euro started to fall and went to new session lows because of an announcement by Germany here. It says that Merkel announced short-selling ban. They announced a ban on short-selling on Wednesday, a coalition told Reuters. They would ban naked short-selling on certain stocks and euro government bonds from midnight tonight. From midnight today, there will be a ban on naked short-selling of certain stocks and euro government bonds. So
she's fearful the financial world there is going to crumble pretty rapidly, isn't she?
We went from a lower dollar this morning, and right now we're sitting up 91 cents on the dollar. And that sort of put a little panic in things. We sold off. We did come back a little bit on the corn on the close, though, off the lows that were made, when that announcement came out. So, you know, it is just a little bit fearful when they put restrictions on free trade.
Indeed. And so what happened in that case is that the currency there dropped, I suppose. Did the euro drop back down and then consequently the dollar went up, or was it just that they made a flight into the dollar?
Oh, I think a little of both has happened here because we went down and set new lows at 1.2163, and our old low had been at 122.34. On Monday there, that was the lowest had been in 4 years on the euro, Todd. So we set a new low on that. So we worked on both sides of the equation there. We took the euro down, and we also brought the dollar back up. And the dollar, of course, is in that 87 resistance area now, the 87.305.
Okay, so what happens then with that in retrospect as you look at the grain market is as the dollar gets stronger, it just means that it costs more to buy goods and services from the United States, including exports of corn and soybeans and wheat and all other kinds of agricultural products.
Yes.
I guess that's enough said.
that's about how the last 15 to 20 minutes of the market around and saw them really, be exaggerated, Todd. So, we just wonder how much lasting effect that'll have on everything here tonight and tomorrow again.
And your expectations for overnight trade are?
Well, you're going to have to say that it's going to be on the weak side of things, just on the way that the currencies are acting here. And it looks like we'll continue not to see the dollar erode. Whether it gains strength or not, I don't know. But I doubt it will erode with the situation the way it is.
All right. Well, we'll keep a close eye on it, and we'll be in contact with you again. Wayne, thanks so much for being with us today.
All righty. Thank you, Todd.
Wayne Nelson is with L&M Commodities out of New Market, Indiana. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Hey, don't forget to visit our website. The address is willag.org. That's willag.org. There you can hear all of our daily agricultural programming, and it's absolutely free. Yesterday afternoon, USDA released its weekly crop progress and weather report. It showed that nationally, corn producers had planted 87% of this year's crop by the week's end. That's 26 percentage points ahead of last year, 9 points ahead of the rolling 5-year average, with below-average temperatures and above-average precip restricting the number of days suitable for field work during the past week. Planting progress was limited to just 5 percentage points or less in the states of Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and Minnesota. Four of the five largest corn-producing states, emergence had advanced to 55% complete for corn by the 16th day of May. That's well ahead of both last year and the 5-year average. Despite the cooler temperatures, double-digit emergence was evidenced across much of the major corn-producing region during the week. Overall, 67% of the corn crop was reported in good to excellent condition. By the week's end, 38% of the 2010 soybean crop had been planted, 15 percentage points ahead of last year, 3 percentage points ahead of the 5-year average. And while planting progress in Iowa, the largest soybean-producing state, surpassed the halfway point during the week, producers in some northernmost areas of Indiana were expecting to replant a small portion of their bean crop because of frost damage incurred during the recent cold spells. Overall, emergence advanced 6 percentage points during the week, leaving progress at 13% complete, 8 percentage points ahead of last year, and 4 points ahead of the 5-year average. Winter wheat now heading of the crop had advanced to 52% complete nationwide. That's slightly behind last year, 4 points behind the 5-year average. Despite the rapid head development in Kansas and Texas, the two largest winter wheat producing states, overall progress remains slightly behind normal. Overall, 66% of the winter wheat crop was reported in good to excellent condition, unchanged from ratings last week, but 18 points better than ratings from this time last year. Now, here are the statisticians from the 5 top corn-producing states with updates from their regions.
This is Greg Tayson, director of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service Iowa Field Office, with the weekly crops and weather report for the week ending May 16, 2010. Iowa received another round of cool, wet conditions, slowing corn emergence and delaying field work. The wettest week in nearly 2 years slowed planting to a crawl, and even though most corn acres are now planted, concerns of frost damage and flooding have producers watching plant development closely. Temperatures in Iowa for the week as a whole averaged 6.45 degrees below normal, and statewide average precipitation was 2.53 inches or more than 2.5 times the weekly normal of 0.94 inches. Corn planting advanced just 3 percentage points for the week to 96%, with progress 1 week ahead of last year and 8 days ahead of the 5-year average. Corn emergence at 66% was well ahead of the 50% last year and the 5-year average of 42%. This season's first reports of corn condition rated the crop at 2% very poor, 7% poor, 36% fair, 50% good, and 5% excellent. 53% of the soybean acreage has been planted, compared with 38% last year and 40% for the 5-year average. Soybeans emerge reached 8%, just 4 percentage points ahead of last year and 3 points ahead of the 5-year average. This is Greg Tayson reporting from the USDA NAS Iowa Field Office.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending May 16th. Cooler than normal temperatures and above normal rainfall spread across much of Illinois last week, causing some low land flooding and ponding in fields. Statewide corn planting advanced to 96% complete. This is well ahead of last year's 19% and the 5-year average of 76%. Emergence advanced to 78% compared to 6% emerged last year and 53% for the 5-year average. The average height of corn emerged was 4 inches compared with 2 inches last year and for the 5-year averages. Overall, the corn crop was rated in mostly good condition. However, there were reports of a few farmers having to do some replanting. Soybean planting advanced to 42% complete compared to 1% planted last year and 36% for the 5-year average. 12% of the soybeans have emerged compared to 8% for the 5-year average. The crop reporting district leading the state in soybean planting progress was the Eastern District at 65%. The soft red winter wheat crop was reported at 60% headed, and this compares to 55% last year and 68% for the 5-year average. 8% of the wheat heads were reported filled, compared with 6% 1 year ago and 16% for the 5-year average. The condition of the wheat crop was rated in mostly fair to good condition. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service with a crop weather report for the week ending May 16, 2010. Temperatures averaged 11 degrees below normal for the week, with portions of the western half of the state dropping below freezing. Precipitation fell across all areas of the state in the form of rain or snow. Panhandle crops were impacted the most last week. Sugar beets will have to be replanted in some areas. Corn planting advanced to 89% complete. This was behind last year's 91, but ahead of the 86 average. Corn emerged was 36% complete, behind last year's 42 and 37 average. Soybean planting was 44% complete, behind last year's 57, but ahead of the 38 average. Soybeans emerged with 6% near last year's 7 and 5 average. Sorghum planting was 17% complete. Wheat conditions rated 73% good or excellent, below the 77% of last year. Wheat jointed was at 60% and a few fields began to head out. Dry bean planting has begun. Alfalfa rated 88% good or excellent, above last year's 76. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
This is Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAF's Minnesota Field Office, with the weekly crop weather report for the week ending May 16, 2010. Steady rains and cool weather early in the week slowed planting but restored needed soil moisture supplies to emerging crops. However, producers reported that crops need more warm temperatures to recover from nearly 2 week spell of wet, cool weather. Soybeans advanced to 47% planted, compared to 49% last year and 38% for the 5-year average. Corn emergence was at 52%, 16 percentage points ahead of last year and 24 points ahead of the 5-year average. 95% of the spring wheat and 93% of the barley was emerged, with both crops at 4% jointing. Oats were 94% emerged, with 7% jointing. Crop conditions for all three small grains were primarily rated good to excellent. Canola and green pea planting was at 92 and 89% complete, respectively, both ahead of last year and the average. Sweet corn was 38% planted, 2 points ahead of last year and 9 points ahead of the average. Sugar beet conditions was virtually unchanged from the previously reported period, with 79% rated in good to excellent condition. That's the weekly crop weather for the week ending May 16, 2010. I'm Doug Hartwig, Director of USDA NAS, Minnesota Field Office.
Hello, this is Greg Preston, Director of the USDA NAS Field Office for Indiana, and this is the crop weather report for the week ending May 16th. Persistent rain for the week slowed field work to a crawl, but the rapid planting pace early in the season has left corn planting about 12 days ahead of the 5-year average. The unrelenting rains has caused some flooding in low-lying areas, and the low temperatures has affected corn emergence, and some fields may need to be replanted. Limited frost damage in northern Indiana counties affected some soybean fields and may also require some replanting. Hay farmers are waiting for a break in the rain to begin the first cutting of hay. 86% of the intended corn acreage has been planted, well ahead of last year's 22% planted at this time and the 5-year average of 68%. By area of the state, 87% has been planted in the north, 91% in the central region, and 75% in southern Indiana. 69% of the planted corn acreage has emerged, ahead of the 7% recorded for last year and the 37% for the 5-year average. 46% of the intended soybean acreage has been planted, compared to 5% for last year and 35% for the 5-year average. 23% of the planted soybean acreage has emerged, well ahead of the 0% recorded last year at this time and the 8% for the 5-year average. 97% of the winter wheat acreage is jointed, compared with 91% for last year and 96% for the 5-year average. 50% of the winter wheat acreage is headed, compared with 36% last year and 41% for the 5-year average. Winter wheat condition fell slightly from last week and is rated 70% good to excellent, compared to 77% last year at this time. This is Greg Preston reporting from the Indiana NAS Field Office.
And I'm Todd Gleason in the offices of Illinois Public Media on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, reminding you of a couple of websites you should visit, of course, for the radio station and the ag programming that you're listening to now from Illinois Public Media. Visit willag.org. That's willag.org. If you're still unsure about your acre decision and didn't sign up last year but are considering it for this year, that's the federal crop insurance program called ACRE. You can always visit this website. It's the Farm Doc site. It's at www.farmdoc.illinois.edu. Let me repeat that for you. It's www.farmdoc.illinois.edu. Gary Schnitke has just posted a webinar there that you can watch and learn more about the ACRE program. It's all at the Farm Doc website. Time now to take a look at what's been happening in the world of agricultural energies. On the line with us from their office in Kansas City for Louis Dreyfus Commodities is Mike Barwinski, a senior trader there. Good afternoon to you, Mike. Thanks, Mike.
Good afternoon.
Tell me about how you're viewing this marketplace. It changes daily, it seems, almost now.
It's been an extremely volatile energy market, but the odd thing of that is that it hasn't quite filtered over into ethanol. We've been trading in a pretty tight range here. Since we spoke last month, we're only up 2 cents, while crude's down $14 in that point in time.
Is that lack of volatility good for you or not good for you?
It makes it a little more difficult because ethanol has always been pressured by either by energy or by corn, so it makes people a little bit confused on where the market's going to go. So I think it's not a good thing in that it makes people tentative and a little more difficult to sell product.
Have you been able to divine which direction it should go?
Looking at the current situation at the forward balance sheet, we have the summer dry receiving come up, and things have certainly gotten better and improved in the last month. We've worn our stocks down, but we also need to keep in mind that we have ADM Columbus or ADM Iowa plant coming online possibly as soon as July.
Has your ethanol plant been running at a pretty good margin?
Yeah, they've improved quite substantially over the last month. Not just from a boost in ethanol, but distillers production as well has picked up.
I remember that you book, I think, and most ethanol plants do, corn not very far out in the future, so you sort of buy hand to mouth. Is that still the case?
When we have the possibility, we try to buy out further if it's a good basis historically. We don't have nearly as much farmer selling out there, though. They've been, more stick to the short term, waiting to sell on price rallies and holding off on any drops in corn prices.
Does that worry you?
No, not necessarily, because we still think they have the corn to sell. It doesn't necessarily worry us that we can't buy it further out because, to be honest, the ethanol margins are good enough to sell forward out that we need to buy corn out in that period of time.
What do you hear from Washington, D.C. on the decision? U.S. EPA has been postponing, but I suppose may make sometime soon.
We hear still positive news that we'll get approval for either E12 or E15, possibly even in the next month, a month and a half. What that means for ethanol is still unclear. There's still a lot of liability issues, a lot of questions on that point. That it may be at least another year till we see increased blendings that from your major refiners.
What do you and your trader friends there in your office make of the announcements this afternoon from Germany about not allowing short sales?
It's pretty shocking, coming from the U.S. market. But then again, we heard talk about this last year at this point when our economy was definitely facing dire straits, and we heard people arguing to ban short selling at that point in time too. So it's shocking that it actually went through, but the fact that they were discussing it isn't so much. It seems like the market kind of took it as a negative, but right now it all depends what's going to happen here in the next month or so.
Mike, thanks so much.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mike Barwinski is with Louis Dreyfus Commodities. He's located in their Kansas City, Missouri office at the Kansas City Board of Trade. In 2 minutes, we'll talk with meteorologist Don Day about the agricultural weather forecast here on Illinois Public Media's Closing Market Report.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, European Union nations are pushing for deep deficit cuts today at a meeting to restore confidence in European governments' ability to handle the debt crisis. Investors fear that European countries will not be able to reduce mounting debt and avoid years of slow economic growth despite a $1 trillion rescue package to help Eurozone nations avoid default. Researchers at the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank say the U.S. economy will probably rebound from the worst downturn since the Great Depression at a faster pace than most economists project. San Francisco Fed officials say the economy, which has grown at a 3.7% annual pace since it bottomed last June, is likely to grow about 4% this year and 3.5% next year. Canada is preparing proposals on stricter banking regulations ahead of next month's G20 summit that it will host in Toronto. Proposals would include regulating the amount of capital reserves financial institutions must have on hand before they lend, and more regulation of the type of instruments that are created, as well as urging governments to look at their mortgage rules to avert future asset bubbles. And China's National Development and Reform Commission today says that China's inflation should rise slightly in May and June, but the overall increase in consumer prices for the first half of the year should be just 2.5% over a year ago. And that's a look at today's business news.
Hey, have you visited our website lately? It's willag.org. That's W-I-L-L-A-G.org. There you'll find all our daily agricultural programming, a way to sign up for it to be delivered to your computer automatically as a podcast, our weekend ag newsletter, and so much more. It's all at W-I-L-L-A-G.org. Please do visit today.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon. Time to check the agricultural weather forecast. Don Day of Day Weather is with us from the beautiful, and I don't know whether it's still a white state of Wyoming at the moment, but apparently it was after we talked last week. Is that right?
That's right. Well, almost all the snow piles melted away yesterday, but it has been cool across many areas of the West, while it has been a little bit warmer here in the Midwest.
And cool enough that, did you say that it was the coolest record May so far, potentially?
Well, there are going to be portions of the northern and central Rockies, and also this would include the Pacific Northwest and parts of California that are tracking right now to have top 5, 10 coolest May on record. So if you've been wondering where some of the cool spring weather has been, it's been staying pretty much out west.
Well, out west, but it's not been particularly warm here for the last week in the Midwest either.
No, not too warm, and that we don't want it too warm in May. If you get May hot, that does not portend well for as you get on into the summer season. And right now, Todd, the way it looks, at least for the next week to 10 days, we're going to continue that trend where temperatures aren't going to be far from normal. Nothing terribly warm expected to come our way. And as we talked last week, seasonal temperatures and still some occasional chances for shower and thunderstorm activity as systems are coming out of the west and will favor most of the Midwest to pick up some precipitation. We don't see a bullseye of any real big precipitation, but we do see many areas from the northern plain states, the northern and western Corn Belt, and into the Ohio Valley having some pretty decent chances of rain over the next week.
As we make our way through the end of May and into June and spring turns to summer in that month, how does the transition normally take place in the Midwest?
Well, we usually start to see the frequency of these systems coming out of the west dropping off. The more widespread shower and thunderstorm coverage we tend to have in early to mid-May tends to become more of a scattered pattern, and also temperatures just start to average a bit warmer, and we really notice this during the nighttime hours. And everything that we're seeing right now is indicating that for the last 10 days of this month into the Memorial Day weekend, we should be trending into what should be a rather typical early June weather pattern.
Take us around the globe and tell us about any of the hot spots you've been watching.
Well, over in China, it looks like rain chances there are going to be pretty good. They're going to have a somewhat active weather pattern that should give coverage of precipitation over most of the growing areas of China. Europe is going to be a little bit warmer and drier in Western Europe. Eastern Europe, Russia, going to be looking at some pretty good chances for precipitation.
Don, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Don Day is with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon. We'll say so long to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you, stay with us for the farming world. Our guest today, Steve Fogelsong. He's the president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. The Farming World is a production of Illinois Public Media. If you have suggestions for guests, please do contact Dave Dickey, Director of Agricultural Programming. The phone number to call is 217-333-1070. That's 217-333-1070.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop
and farming world news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with the president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Steve Fogelsong. Fogelsong is the owner of the Black Gold Ranch located here in the great state of Illinois. With his wife and children, he operates a cow-calf feedlot and a stocker heifer development program. As it happens, Fogelsong is also a graduate of the University of Illinois in Animal Sciences. Mr. Fogelsong, it's always a pleasure to speak with an alum of this university. Thank you so much for taking your time.
Glad to be here.
Can you tell me what the National Cattlemen's Beef Association is and why you're involved?
Well, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association is a trade association, and we work to ensure and enhance profitability from both our policy side and our checkoff side within the beef industry. And we try to make sure that we get producers where they can actually make a little money, and then we try to make sure that the government lets us keep it in our pockets. So both of those things work side by side, hand in hand, and we work to promote beef all across the country and around the world.
It's probably an interesting position you're in because you're a producer of beef and know full well that most view the red meat that you produce as a luxury. Is that a difficult place to be as a producer?
No, it's a great deal. And people are going to have celebrations. Everybody's happy. We're going to pick beef. That's kind of our goal. You obviously would like for people to eat it like I do, which is, at least once a day, if not more than that. But we're happy that folks really like our product, and they do, and that's a great thing. It's great. It's great for you, and all of our research proves all that out, and leads to a really good, healthy lifestyle, and people appreciate that.
You live in the western part of the state of Illinois. It's a state with some of the best soils in the world to produce corn. Beef cattle, of course, consume corn as a primary feed ingredient. It is finite in supply, and your industry shares it with other folks, including a new player on the block. That's called corn-based ethanol for biofuel. Is competition from the ethanol industry a big concern for you locally or as the president of the NCBA?
Well, those of us that live in this state in particular have the advantage of being able to take advantage of cheap byproducts that come out of those ethanol plants. There's others around the country that aren't as close, so their feed costs a lot more. But, for us locally, the ethanol thing's good. It put a lot of money on Main Street, and that's good for the communities, here in the Midwest. When farmers are making money, they're really good about spending it, and that's good for everybody. And those of us in the cattle industry here in the state, we've learned how to use these byproducts. We certainly feed an awful lot of it, not only to our cow herd, but we use a lot of it in our feed yard. If these ethanol industries are going to be successful and profitable, it's important to be able to move that byproduct.
Speaking of putting money on Main Street, livestock in particular is a good place for rural Americans to find employment. Do you have numbers of how many are employed on the farm by the beef cattle industry nationwide?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what those numbers would be, but I know I've seen some economic analysis that was done, and livestock money that's spent for livestock ends up turning over about 7 times, in the community. Because you've got all kinds of ancillary industries that are outside. You got guys that drive trucks, guys that bring feed. You got veterinarians. You've got the guy at the local hardware store. We're best friends because I'm in there every day. And those are all things that are generated by a livestock operation. You want to talk about rural development, and you want to talk about value added. Where we take a crop and we add value to it. Those things are all happen because of livestock. Cattle and swine, all the stuff that we grow here in Illinois, those are good things. I've spent a lot of time in Nebraska and in Iowa, places, where livestock really is king out there. And you get in those communities and you see that those are the drivers, that are making that whole place work. And those economies statewide are very healthy because of the livestock industry.
On the state level, what are the big problems livestock producers face? Is it siting new facilities?
No, really, Illinois is great. We have got a set of rules with the Livestock Management Facilities Act that outlines in a very practical and very, very well thought, because they're looking at your neighbors, they're looking at where you're going to site it, they look for environmental issues, all of those things are played out, and if you meet all of those goals, then you can go ahead and do what you need to do to raise your livestock. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's a great, great tool for everybody's protection and tries to keep everybody in mind. You know, and I don't have a problem with that at all. You know, and we have some great people to work with. You know, the oversight of those falls to the EPA and the guys at the state EPA. You know, they understand it. They'll come out if there's a problem. You know, we get our heads together and we work it out and try to find resolution to that problem. And I think it's a great relationship, and it makes Illinois a great place to live if you're in the livestock business.
Are you more concerned about federal regulations, for instance, from the United States Environmental Protection Agency?
Well, you know, there's going to be some concerns there because it seems like in this administration, what we have started to see, we've seen some of that happening, you know, where the federal group doesn't particularly think that their own state agencies are doing the job correctly. And so they're kind of rolling in over the top of them. And, you know, that's an unfortunate situation. You've got a working relationship, every livestock producer, with the Illinois EPA. I mean, you know where the ground rules are. You work with those ground rules, you know the people, and you know how to, you know, to make it work. And then when you get another person coming in over the top, it gets to be kind of a turf deal, and then the livestock producer can ultimately get stuck in the middle of it with no way to know who's on first and you know, how to work through that. That's an unfortunate situation, and we're seeing some of those things right now where we're having regulations that are being driven from a totally different perspective because it's coming straight from D.C., and not going through legislation. It's kind of backdoor politics, and that's an unfortunate situation, and it's hard for the relationships and those communities, you know, that have to deal with that.
Is it hard because it's such a large and vast country with varying needs from one region to another, so that regs that fit with your ranch might not fit one in Arizona?
Well, that's part of it. You know, we in Illinois get, you know, between 36 and 40 inches of rainfall, you know, so we're not going to be the same as an outfit in Nebraska. You know, they get 28 inches of rainfall, you know, so you're going to have to do some things different. And I think if you try to put one set of rules across the whole country and go around, you know, the folks that have been doing a great job for the last 20 years, you know, in particular your state groups who have a relationship on that farm, it makes it pretty bad. And you wind up breaking the trust. And I think that ultimately is the deal. You know, farmers, you know, if you've got a relationship with somebody at your state level, and you trusted them, and you know you've not been led astray by those people, and you get along, that's a relationship that needs to be continued. Because at the end of the day, it's all about people and their attitudes, and trying to get it. Every farmer wants to do the best job he can, you know, and he will work with folks. And the problem is, you get other folks that want to, you know, have a different agenda, and not find the solution to the problems, and then it all comes apart because then the trust is broken, and everybody gets in a defensive mode, and that's an unfortunate situation.
And most of this would have to do with nutrient or manure management and water quality, correct?
Well, that's where it starts because that's an easy target. You know, there's a lot less livestock folks out there, but it's not a very big leap, you know, to get right into nutrient management from any source. You know, I mean, the livestock guys are simple, but right now, you know, running up and down the road, there's a million anhydrous bottles. Everybody sees them. You know, they're all out there. Everybody's putting out fertilizer on their crops one way or the other. Nitrogen is nitrogen. Doesn't make any difference how it comes. It's all the same thing. You know, it just depends. You know, we're particular about ours. We consider all of our nitrogen to be organic because we use nothing but manure, you know, but at the end of the day, it's the same nutrients that we're putting out there. And then there's the whole issue with chemicals, you know, that are being used on the crops. And you know, so it's not a very big leap to go from one to the other and understand that we're all at risk and we're all under the same microscope.
But you're all working toward the same goal, which is to keep soil and water in healthy condition.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to make a bridge then to your recent trip to Brazil. You were there with the Nature Conservancy. What were you exploring?
We were looking at the effects of the deforestation in the Amazon and how that will affect carbon and global warming, and what to do about it, and you know, we're making suggestions and learning about that, and had a great trip and really learned an awful lot about what the farmers and ranchers in Brazil have done and what they're trying to do in the future, and then what role we could play in that.
Was this organized by the Conservancy or the National Cattlemen's Beef Association?
No, it was organized by the Nature Conservancy. And we had two or three guys that were from the agriculture, a couple of guys that were from forestry, and then a group of people that were from the U.S. Nature Conservancy. And we went around. And I think it was an opportunity for us to be in a give-and-take mode. Not only did I learn an awful lot about their perspective on global warming and carbon, but they learned my perspective as well on agriculture, you know, and raising food in a world that where we have to raise, you know, twice as much food here in the next 20 years just to feed the population, and understanding that has to happen for all of us, and there's a balance that needs to be struck between all these goals. And I think we had a very good and very spirited conversation, and I think we all probably moved off of where we were when we went in there.
What did you see in Brazil as you were there?
Well, we spent time in some very, very rural areas of the Amazon. Part of it we went to by boat, you know, so we saw folks that were subsistence farmers, basically, but trying to break out of that and produce food. Most of it was actually producing cocoa, which, you know, chocolate, you know, because they grow that stuff in the forest itself, and showing that they could be profitable and raise products in the forest without taking the forest apart. You know, and we spent a lot of time on cattle ranches, which are some of them very, very huge. I was on a ranch that had 100,000 cows, which is a huge number, and saw some agriculture on huge soybean fields, you know, that have been, in some situations, pasture that had been previously cleared and then converted into crops. And then we spent an awful lot of time talking to government officials that were there, and they were talking about the role that the government has played, where they're asking or demanding, really, producers to set aside 50% to 80% of their acres and put a lot of that back into forest, or purchase other land that could be as a set aside. And so basically, if you owned 100 acres, you're going to need 50 of that to be in forest. And that's their goal, is to get everybody in that. And they've got some rules. They'll shut you off without credit, and you won't have a market to sell your products to. So, I mean, the Brazilian farmers have got some issues, not unlike some of the issues that we face here in our country, but a little more heavy-handed, I would say. It didn't look like it'd be all that much fun to work with.
That's Steve Fogelsong. He's the president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. He's speaking to us here on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. More with him when we return.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
It's National Cheese Soufflé Day. It's also Rooster Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1808, Elijah Craig died, a Baptist minister in Kentucky. He was an important figure in the invention of bourbon whiskey. He ran a paper mill and started a distillery in 1789. Legend credits him with being the first to use new charred oak barrels to age corn whiskey, which is a key step in making bourbon. In 1824, Wilhelm Hofmeister was born, a German botanist. He discerned the regular alternation of sexual and asexual generations in plants, which is the basis for the explanation of the life cycle in all known plants. In 1875, Robert Horton was born, an American hydraulic engineer. He is considered the father of modern hydrology. His studies established a basis for the analysis of soil erosion that enabled strategies for soil conservation. In 1935, Alan Burns was born. He was the creator of the character Captain Horatio Magellan Crunch for Quaker Oats Captain Crunch breakfast cereal. And in 2001, Hong Kong ordered more than 1 million chickens and other poultry killed to halt the spread of a bird flu epidemic. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for agricultural programming comes from the Westchester Group, an agricultural asset management firm specializing in land auctions for farmland, timberland, and recreational land. More information on upcoming auctions is at westchester-auctions.com or at 800-607-6888.
You're listening to The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with the president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Western Illinois cattle producer Steve Fogelsong. Mr. Fogelsong, when you spoke with landowners while you were in Brazil, did they discuss, as some governmental officials and a few of the landowners there have, from the rainforest region anyway, world payments for setting aside large tracts of untouched lands that could be turned into working farms?
You know, we haven't got to that point, but there were certainly some inferences there. I think if I understood it correctly, I think what we're really seeing is, you're correct, we will be asked to, but we'll probably be asked to through increased costs on goods and services, you know, that we buy and purchase here in this country. One example that they had was, I think, the Marriott Hotel. Anytime you stay at Marriott, they take a dollar from your tag, you know, whatever you're going to pay, and they send it, you know, to Brazil. And some Brazilian farmer ultimately winds up getting it as a payment to set aside acres. And I think that's probably where they're wanting to go, and we'll probably see more of that, you know, in the very near future.
Does it give you any ideas of how to deal with, for instance, climate change legislation here in the United States?
Well, it does to some extent. You know, we're still struggling with the science, and I think from the NCBA's perspective, we want to make sure everything's science-based, because sometimes we're guilty of running off and doing things, you know, maybe in a knee-jerk fashion, and we haven't really put the numbers to it and understood exactly where it is. There'll be some more conversations about paying folks for capturing carbon through trees or grassland or something like that. And I think ultimately everyone in the country will ultimately pay for this, and it'll just be tacked on, you know, as an added cost, you know, on whatever food or whatever products or services that you're about to get. So that's where we'll ultimately be into it. So that's the debate that will continue to go on.
Has agriculture, do you think, lost clout in Washington, D.C. over your time as an agricultural policy activist?
You know, I've been involved in this deal for 25 years. And when I first became involved and spent time in D.C., you know, you could go into virtually any legislator's office and be greeted by their ag aide, who was a graduate of a land-grant university. I mean, that was the deal. You go in there, and that's who you'd greet. Today, when you go in there, you're more likely to be greeted by somebody that's got a degree in history or political science, but very seldom does it wind up being an ag person, because, you know, the reality of it is our populace has switched from being largely rural to virtually all urban. And consequently, then, NCBA's role has changed as well, because you can't just go in there and say, okay, here's our issue, and I'm sure you understand it, this is the way we'd like you to vote. Today you got to go in there and you have to start explaining the very basics of agriculture and the very basis by what we do. We have to go in and explain what farming or cattle ranching is all about, at a level that's far, far less than what those of us that grew up in agriculture are used to. So we've got to go in there and explain that, and then we can start having a conversation about the legislation that we're talking about. So it's taken a lot more time, and we have changed our focus dramatically to one now where I would say it's probably well over half of it is all about education and teaching our legislators and the staff that serves them exactly what it is we do for a living. We cannot, as producers, any longer sit on the sidelines and assume that people know because they don't.
It was easier in the earlier era, I suppose. Is it okay with you that you feel the need to teach them?
Yeah, it is. It's unfortunate that our society has moved away from agriculture so far. But, I guess the challenge to us, and every time I talk to producers, get the opportunity, it's not enough anymore to just produce food and fiber for virtually the whole world. Today, we have to tell people why we do it and how we do it and educate them as well. And it's not enough to sit on the sidelines and do what you have done for the last 20 years, raising crops. You've got to pick up the sword and be willing to go out and have a two-minute elevator conversation with somebody, that really doesn't understand you and in a lot of situations has misinformation that has led them to have beliefs about agriculture that are incorrect. And I don't think any of us should be willing to accept what we see in the media about agriculture and just sit by and take it. I think it's our responsibility as folks involved in this and where we get our livelihood to step in and tell our story. It's a great story to tell, and we just need to make sure we get that story told correctly.
Mr. Fogelsong, I hope you'll come back in the future and tell us more of that story.
I would absolutely love to.
Thank you so much. We do appreciate your time.
Anytime.
Steve Fogelsong is the president of the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and the owner of the Black Gold Ranch in Western Illinois. He's been talking to us here today on The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. You have a good afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.